My guest today is Dr. Christiane Northrup. She is a visionary pioneer in women's health, a board-certified OBGYN, and New York Times bestselling author of Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom, The Wisdom of Menopause, and Goddesses Never Age, as well as the host of 8 highly successful public television specials. Her work has been featured on The Oprah Winfrey Show, The Today Show, NBC Nightly News, The View, Rachel Ray, Good Morning America, 2020, and The Dr. Oz Show, among many others. Dr. Northrup was named one of the most 100 trusted people in America by Reader's Digest in 2013, and one of Oprah Winfrey's Super Soul 100, a group of leaders who are using their voices and talent to awaken humanity. Dr. Northrup has also been named one of the Watkins Spiritual 100, a list of living people that make a unique and spiritual contribution on a global scale in 2020, 2021, and 2022. In December 2022, Dr. Northrup was one of 6 women to receive the Zelenko Foundation Rosa Parks Award, and honored for standing up for truth, God, and light against all odds, smears, obstacles, and censorship. You will find more about Dr. Northrup and the many ways she continues to inspire and awaken humanity in the podcast notes below. I'm very honored to have her as our guest today.
Welcome to Interspecies Evolution. The purpose of this podcast is to highlight human consciousness and how our self-awareness can lead to our honoring animals as conscious beings as well. We have gathered more than 3 dozen people with unique experiences and education, inviting them to share their journeys and how their relationships with animals have changed along the way. If you are seeking inspiration on your own journey of awakening, or simply want to improve your relationships with animals, we invite you to join us because it is time for interspecies evolution. Here's your host, Jenny Jablonski.
Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Northrup.
Thank you, Jenny. So good to be here.
I am just thrilled that you were able to take time to come and have a conversation with us. And if I had my druthers, I'd have you for 6 hours. But I'm pretty sure we have about an hour. So I'm going to stop talking. Okay. And I'm going to ask you to share your journey, to share the ups and downs, to share not only your personal spiritual awareness, how that impacted your education, your career, and how you've gotten to this place.
Okay, let's just start really at the beginning. So I come from a family of medical professionals. My dad was a dentist. His brother and sister were medical doctors, and they always made fun of him. We grew up on health food. We had a compost heap. We took vitamin C. My parents followed Adele Davis. When my mother was pregnant with her, I think 4th child, she developed viral pneumonia, and they treated it daily with an antibiotic. Every day, every day, every day. The family even went to Florida to get in the sun. And she then gave birth to Bonnie Lori, who I named. And that baby would not eat and died at 6 months in a pool of her own vomit, with my mother looking through a little window in the hospitals at that time, because they didn't let people come in, because the hospitals were fortresses against germs and they couldn't have anyone come in. Then my mother got pregnant with my brother, Bill. And when he was, I forget how old, he wouldn't eat. And he vomited everything up, and they took him to the hospital. And one night, a nurse came up to my mother when she was visiting and said, "Mrs. Northrup, if I were you, I'd get him out of here. The doctors don't know what they're doing," which would never happen now. It would never happen now. And so they signed him out of the hospital against medical advice. And my dad, who had worked in a MASH unit restructuring faces in World War II, certainly knew how to put down a feeding tube, a nasogastric tube. So we all fed him every hour on the hour for nearly a year. At a year old, he weighed 10 pounds. The doctors told my mother that he was mentally defective and that whatever. And she said, I just, you know, the mothers know. And she said, no, I knew he was fine. And he had a great personality at a year. And one day she found a doctor, and my aunt and uncle were trying to help. And we referred him to a Dr. Crump at Women's Medical in Philadelphia. My mother took him down. She took the tube out, and she was a pioneer in fiber optic visualization. And she put down the fiber optic cable. By the way, the fiber optic technology came from Area 51, from the ETs, just so everyone knows. And so she put that down, and the doctor said the esophagus is so eroded that if you continue to keep that NG tube down in there, he'll perforate it and die from that. So they took that out. And she said, imagine this. Let's just wait and see what happens. And in 2 days, he started to eat. The first thing they gave him, which was incredibly stupid in my opinion, was orange juice, which would burn an esophageal ulcer. But he'd drink it, scream, and then drink it and scream because he was so hungry. And I remember my mother bringing him home. We all met them at the airport, and he was eating a roll that the stewardess had given him on the plane. And it was the first time I'd ever seen him without adhesive tape on his face, holding the NG tube in place. And we all cried. And to this day, the doctors, we never knew what was going on. Now, God works in interesting ways. So when I was interviewing for med school, the guy who was my interviewer had been my brother's attending physician. And he was certain that my brother would be dead. You don't, as a doctor, you don't forget those cases where you utterly failed. And I was happy to tell him that my brother was alive and well and doing very well. No thanks to you. Okay. So I was very radicalized before I went to med school. Also, at the age of 12, I found a book called Natives of Eternity by Flower Newhouse. And she was a Christian mystic with the Christ Word Ministry. And I read this book voraciously, and it had all about the nature spirits and the divas of the wind and the divas of the fire and the angels of death. And I was so uplifted by that. Oh my goodness, you know, what I've always thought was true is in fact true. So I began a series of breakfasts with the woman who had been at the Christ Word Ministry, and we talked about angels and all of that. All of my teenage years, I also read every book by Edgar Cayce, The Sleeping Prophet. And I read also all the novels of, I can't remember her name, but Winged Pharaoh, Joan Grant, Winged Pharaoh, The Red Feather. All of her novels were actually based on her past lives. So when I got to med school, I already had quite a background. Then my sister was killed when she was 23 in a car accident. And I was a second year resident. By the way, I just wept when I first saw a baby born. And it was like, this is what you need to go into. You know, it was like there was nothing else like it. That was it. But my second year of residency, my sister was killed. And we all went home for the funeral. It was one of those Buffalo 7 feet of snow in, you know, 8 hours. And I got stuck in the airport, and then I got back to the hospital. And I remember sitting on the bed of so many of these young women dying of cancer. And I would say to them, make certain you say everything that needs to be said to your family. You know, it's as Alex Collier says, what we're judged on is where we withheld love. And so I kind of knew that. And so I was made a better doctor by that entire experience. But then the other thing that happened is my mother began to go to a spiritualist church where a woman was channeling, and she brought the woman to our house, and the woman channeled Dr. Andre, who said that my grandmother, who had died 9 months before, that she was in the car when my sister passed, that she helped her across the portal. And I'd never had an experience like that, where a woman's entire body was taken over by another entity. And of course, that can be good or bad. We all know that. This was, by their fruits ye shall know them. And she was incredibly helpful, because I realized things are way bigger than we think they are. We are immortal beings, and we've had many different experiences. So we had that happen. And then I went along. I learned proprioceptive writing, because I couldn't write a scientific article. I just, you know, on those multiple choice tests, I don't know if they still do them, but in the medical boards and all of it, it was, you know, A, B, and C are correct, D only, none, all of them, whatever. In those multiple choice tests, I could always find a reason why one of the choices was correct. So those things made me crazy. I had a very feminine brain, still have it, where everything's related to everything else. And so school, believe it or not, was a struggle for me, even though I graduated valedictorian. But the only reason that was that I would figure out what they wanted to hear, and then I would put that down. But I hadn't found my writer's voice. I didn't know what I personally really thought until I did 7 years of proprioceptive writing, which is a ritual. You light a candle, you play the second movement of a Baroque piece of music, Mozart, this kind of thing, which is 60 cycles per second. It entrains the brain. You take 3 deep breaths and you come up writing. If you're interested in that, the book is called Writing the Mind Alive by Linda Trichter Metcalf. And I worked with Linda and her partner Toby for 7 years until I broke through to my own writer's voice, what I had to say. And I remember I was beginning to do, by now we were at Women to Women. I left my practice. I joined a great practice in South Portland, Maine, right after I finished my residency. And what happened then is I had my second child, and I asked if I could come in Mondays at 10 in the morning, just get a little extra time on the weekend to be with my children. And I was told, well, you could do that, but we'll have to cut your salary in half. And I had no role models, none, for women who had children who were being doctors. There just weren't any. There are now 50%, more than 50% of the OBGYNs are women now. And most, they all have children, but there was nobody. And I remember thinking, this is not workable. And one of my colleagues, the only other woman who did not have children at that time, developed aseptic necrosis of the hip. And she had to be out for a long period of time to get a hip replacement. And she drew a cartoon that changed my life. And here was the cartoon. Here lies MEF for her name. And it was the tombstone of her tombstone. Here lies MEF. And then on the tombstone was OVI, office visit initial, 8,000, whatever, new OB, NOB, office visit. And she gave all the statistics that were kept every month in our practice for how much productivity you did. And what I was trying to do was keep women out of the operating room. And I had great colleagues. I loved them, but I would refer the people to the guys who did the GYN cancer, the guys who did the fertility, the guys who did the colposcopy for cervical stuff. And I went to see our lawyer at the time, our practice lawyer. And I said, look, I bring in more new patients than anyone here. So I'm a rainmaker for this practice. And he looked at me and he said, you're just going to have to do more surgery. And we had a practitioner who was putting a laparoscope in every woman who came in with even one little twinge in her pelvis. Well, you know, we better find out, you know. And so I thought, this is untenable with my beliefs. And so at that time, there were two nurse practitioners who started something called Women to Women. And one had worked for me. She did Reiki healing and all of that sort of thing. And so both Ellen and I, the doctor who'd had the aseptic necrosis and wrote the, you know, wrote the thing, the cartoon, we realized at the end of our lives, if all we've contributed is this kind of productivity, doing procedures on people, what happens to our soul and what happens to the fact that you really cannot heal anybody, but you can hold up a vibration, a frequency that healing is possible. And you do that by talking to the patient and getting a history. By the way, now with Medicare, they will pay for a history or a physical, but not both. You have to choose. This is insanity. It's insanity. Anyway, we both left the practice, and this was in the 80s, and we started Women to Women, which was the first women-only practice in the United States at the time. And we opened our doors in 1985. We borrowed money from the bank. It was the 80s. We didn't have to put any money down. And the other thing that we had agreed upon at the time was that we would work together as women and not let husbands overly get involved. Because I've seen this pattern over and over and over where a woman doesn't trust herself in business. Her husband comes in, and once he sees that it's a good deal, he starts to take over and run it. So we didn't want that to happen to us. And so we started Women to Women, and that was 85. And then I worked there for, 85 to 1997. And we had the two nurse practitioners, and then we had the doctors. And that was where I did the laboratory work, as it were, for women's bodies, women's wisdom. And we had Patricia Rice, who was an amazing, she did Therapeia, and she would do the biosymbology of the body. And our patients would work in depth with her. So for instance, if you had six yeast infections in a year, I knew it wasn't a monostat deficiency. I knew there was something more going on. So they would work with Patricia. And then I would talk to Patricia, and I realized I also at that time was working closely with Carolyn Mace, the medical intuitive who wrote Anatomy of the Spirit. And I even had her on speed dial, by the way. She would do a reading for $25 on anybody. And at any time, only 5% of my patients would even take advantage of it, because there was a part of them that didn't want to know what it really was. Now, we've all been raised on things that are lies, the germ theory of disease, without understanding the terrain theory. And that's an ancient, well, not ancient, but it's Louis Pasteur and Antoine Beauchamp. And on his deathbed, Pasteur said, Beauchamp was right. It is the environment, the terrain, not the germ. So we know that the germ only starts to overgrow, like in the vaginal area, when you're out of balance. But what Western medicine does is it treats the symptom, and it never gets to the heart of what it is. And I will tell you, the heart of what it is every single time, almost every single time, unless, you know, a bus hits you, it's biosymbolic. It's biosymbolic. And gynecology is the study of the second chakra in the body, which is how one deals with sex, power, and money, because it's our ovaries, our creative drive. They're the body center of creativity. And so I learned from Carolyn Mace what all the chakras were. And if you read Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom, my first book, you'll see charts in there that give what's the balance of that chakra supposed to be. They're just energy systems. They're fiber optic cables in the body, but they're symbolic. They're associated with different belief systems. So first chakra is your bones, your blood, and your immunity. So after 9/11, the heart attack rate at our hospital, it either doubled or tripled. Now, we weren't anywhere near New York City. Why did that happen? Because people were scared to death about their survival. That's first chakra. That's first chakra. It is the, it's the buildings, it's the belief system you got from your family and all of that. And where we are right now in the entire world is we're having to update our first chakra beliefs. Who do you trust? You know, do you trust the doctor explicitly? Oh, the doctor knows better. The teacher knows better. We have teachers unions now telling parents, we have master's degrees, so we know way more than you about how to educate your child because you don't have those degrees. That's interesting because my child's body was made in my body and my body made a child. You didn't, I did. Anyway, so there's that. Anyhow, I then, back in the early 80s, I became a board member of the American Holistic Medical Association, which was started in 1979 by neurosurgeon Norm Shealy. And he and Carolyn Mace worked together for years and years. And through that, I had social support. I'd go to those meetings and there were other doctors like me. We had one radiologist from Washington, D.C. I used to make me laugh and he'd say, every now and then in my office, I go out and I open the window and I yell out, holistic. Now, really, the word holistic at that time was one of those trigger words that you didn't say. It was considered a bad word. Anyhow, so I was always, I want everyone to get this. I was always, always, always walking a razor's edge because everything I was doing, everything I was saying was not the way Western medicine worked. I also, at the end of my residency, began to work with Michio Kushi of the East-West Foundation. He brought macrobiotics to the United States. And my cousin called me and she said, I'm treating my fibroids with a macrobiotic diet. And I think, you know, maybe you should meet Michio Kushi. Now, I've always been open to that because of the way I was brought up. My parents were joggers way back. My mother did yoga when I was 11. So we were always delving into those things. And I also, by the way, in college, in the early 70s, I learned transcendental meditation and actually studied with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi in a baseball cage at UMass in the 70s and had my parents bring my harp up so I could play for him. So I was open to things like that and the food. And Michio and I became friends. I sat with him and then I sat in with him while he did his what was called oriental diagnosis, where he'd look at the face, he'd look at the tongue. He'd, you know, that's a standard Chinese medicine. And I would watch, they'd come in with their charts, their medical charts, you know, this high, they'd need a shopping cart for their medical charts. And I call that diagnosis chartomegaly, like, you know, the chart got too big. And what was amazing was that some of those people got better, like really quickly within a month of doing a whole food diet, their faces changed, their everything changed. Now they had to change everything, get on organic food. And I'm not recommending a macrobiotic diet to people. It's good for some. And a cleanse is important for everybody, you know, to get off crappy food on a regular basis to cleanse your body. But anyhow, because I saw those miracles, I began to be the doctor for the macrobiotic community in Boston. And they would come all the way to Maine, and I knew what they were trying to do with the quality of their blood. So when they came to me, I wasn't calling them quacks. I wasn't doing any of that. By the way, the word quack was invented by the Rockefellers in the when they did the Flexner Report in about 1910 or so, when they went after all of the homeopathic, acupuncture, women's medical, naturopathic, all of it, to shut them down. And they wanted to bring in standard pharmaceutical medicine, most of which is petroleum-based, And that was the Rockefeller Foundation. Then when people started to get sick, they founded the American Cancer Society. I've spoken in front of the American Cancer Society, and it's always interesting. They're never interested in anything that actually cures cancer. Same with the MS Society. The MS Society is interested in wheelchairs, crutches, mobility devices, but God forbid you ever send them a book about someone who recovered. And I watched this over and over and over and over. And what always bothered me was the unbelievable hubris of my profession when someone comes in and they've been healed by something that's not in Western medicine. A scientist, an honest person, would say, wow, what did you do? I want to learn more. That's not what happens. I once had a woman who had knee pain, and she got cured with alfalfa tablets because the alfalfa root goes way deep into the earth and there were trace minerals in there and whatever. She just got better. Her internist called my office and complained about me. He had not done anything to heal her knee pain, but I had. And I remember this because I'd go back to my residency when I first published Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom, and I went back to visit all of the people I trained with. I handed the book to the chief of my program, Dr. George Mitchell, who I loved. And he looked at me and he said, whatever happened to you? You used to be one of our best residents. Because I was mentioning food and I was mentioning emotions and all of the rest of it. When I first wrote Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom, the only reason that I wrote it is that I was seeing things that no one else was talking about, even in holistic medicine. So I'd go to the American Holistic Medical Association and they still didn't. It was like women's cyclic nature, menstrual cycle, the ovaries. It was like terra incognita. No one knew what to do with any of it. You don't go, if you went to a holistic book and you put in ovaries or uterus or something, they'd say, see Kundalini. Like the only thing that was happening was that the second chakra was a stage on the way to the Kundalini rising. There was nothing about, you know, what I would say is, there's a long way from an abnormal pap smear to Kundalini, or a long way from enormous PMS to Kundalini. So I had to invent a language of women's health, because the entire language of women's health up to that time, what is women's health even now? Women's health is disease screening. It's pap smears. It's HPV screening. It's mammograms. And then after 50, it's more mammograms and colonoscopies. And so it's all about disease screening. Now, along the way, I met some wonderful people within the profession who would back me up. You often find that, but they, you know, they have to keep quiet about it. I met G. Gilbert Walsh, who wrote a book called Should I Be Tested for Cancer? Maybe not. And what he pointed out was, for every woman who gets a mammogram, you've got, I used to have it on the tip of my tongue, but he published it in the New England Journal. And so if you take about 100 women who get a mammogram, only 8 out of that will be helped. And the others will be taken into putting a nail in their own coffin because they're now scared to death. And unneeded biopsies, unneeded surgery, because a lot of times screening will find things that you will die with, but not die from. Case in point is ductal carcinoma in situ of the breast, which is called, listen to this, this is called stage zero cancer. It goes nowhere in 99% of women. Because I know so much about mammography, I've never had one. Just like, no, sorry, we're not doing it. That test makes no sense to me. Has it saved some lives? Yeah. but it's messed up hundreds, thousands more. So it was this kind of thing. Now, I was on the cover of East West Journal, which then became Natural Health. This was Micho Kushi's first publication. It was in the natural food thing when this was just starting to come in. And I asked the editors of the East West Journal, please do not publish that picture until I have completed my oral board examinations to become board certified. So please don't publish it. So they didn't publish it until whatever year that was, December of 1980 or something. And I asked the people at the food co-op to please tell me when that issue would hit the stands. And they did. And I went in and I bought every single issue so that the doctors in my practice would not see me being interviewed in this alternative thing. And that worked pretty well. Meanwhile, up in labor and delivery at Maine Medical Center, I'm getting calls from all over the world, you know. So all of that, that was the prequel really to finally writing Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom, which was inventing a language of women's health, showing women what was biosymbolic and showing them the wisdom of their bodies so that they could turn things around naturally. And it still holds water because regardless of how you decide to treat something, the biosymbology is the key and taking responsibility is the key. And that includes everybody. That includes taking responsibility for the parents you chose when you came to Earth, taking responsibility for the choices that you have made, because this is schoolroom Earth. When you make progress on this planet by changing your frequency, uplifting yourself, it affects the entire galaxy. So you didn't come here by mistake. I know it feels, you know, when people say, I didn't ask to be born. Well, yeah, you did, actually. But it's not the ego part of you. It's a part of you that's just sort of way bigger. It's the 10,000 foot view. So I knew all that. And then when the book first came out, I began to have nightmares that someone was in the house with a gun and they were going to kill me. And I'd wake up screaming. And I think it was because I was walking through and breaking up the morphogenic field of all the women who've been burned as witches. I think 9 million during the Malficorum, which is the hammer of the witches, when the Spanish Inquisition and the Catholic Church decided to get rid of all the women who were healers and who were herbalists and who were midwives. We can't have that. So I went sort of walking through the flames of that. And I also think that I probably had lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, either as a nun, as an herbalist, but hiding. And this lifetime was, okay, this time you're going to finally say what you know, and you're going to go to Dartmouth Medical School. And you're going to be board certified and you're going to graduate from Tufts New England Medical Center. You're going to be a clinical assistant professor of OBGYN for 30 years, which I was, so that your credentials will be unassailable. They'll be impeccable. And that's why then after Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom came in and you know, so I had all these dreams and all, then I went into Grand Rounds. All my doctor colleagues are there. And nobody said a thing. And I realized, oh, okay. So most people are just going about their lives. And, you know, I continued. And my colleagues, by the way, always made fun of me, but I didn't mind because if it's in loving, if it's in, you know, we know you're a little weird out there compared to us, but, you know, but we love you and you're included in the jokes. Then I knew we're safe. So I was included. I'll give you an example. At one of our residency graduations, the residents are graduating and they do a roast of all the attending physicians. So here's one, and they show someone dressed up as me. And she's doing a Leboyer birth because I would, you know, do delayed cord clamping, have a gentle birth, all of that, try to talk people out of circumcision. That didn't work well. It's working better now. And so they had this, here's Dr. Northrup doing a LaBoye birth. Then the next image they show is a receiving blanket with big fibroids on it that have been taken out surgically. And the caption is another case of failed macrobiotics. Well, you know, I mean, that was my life. I also, by the way, had my first lawsuit because I happened to be in the operating room at the wrong time. Everyone's named. That's the way it is. My third year of residency, sheriff arrives on my doorstep and I'm served. I'd never seen anything like it. And I quickly learned that the legal system is theater. The depositions are theater. It wasn't about what really happened. It's theater. I've had a total of eight lawsuits, eight. Two of them, the second to last one, no, there were two after that. Okay, two with PBS shows. One was, I got two on the same day. Two on the same day. One was a patient I'd never even seen. And that's when I knew it was the message from my inner being, you got to leave practice. Because what happens is, in our culture, you're the victim, you're a victim of the disease and whatever, and the doctor is supposed to heal it. And therefore, if you say anything that can be misconstrued, if she's a nutbag or whatever, then you're a target. Now, most of the lawsuits were just, they were just basic, you know, failure to diagnose ovarian cancer early. Well, guess what? We don't know how to do that. We still don't know how to do that. And I happen to know what the ovarian cancer archetype is. So I would go way out on a limb and tell women with breast cancer, whatever, what the energetics were so that they could switch it. But most people still have a very injured, wounded little child inside. And therefore, the inner child. Now, note this, everybody listening. It is the inner child who will commandeer your immune, your endocrine, and your central nervous systems. So when you get triggered, you know, like we got now an entire generation of people who are, oh, don't say this trigger word. My God, you're making sure they never grow up, that they never take responsibility, that they never know how to work through anything that's hard. They will never, ever achieve the crowning glory of life on earth as long as you're running for the victim position. So you can imagine within the medical, Western medical paradigm, I was an enigma. So I finally, in 97, left. I also had two lawsuits from PBS. One was, it was beyond belief. Okay, beyond belief. A friend of mine had sent a letter to me that her mother from England sent her on her 40th birthday. And it was this beautiful letter. And I said, can I use that as an example of how healing is always possible at any time of life? She'd never gotten along with her mother. And the mother would never tell her who her father was. And she'd grown up, you know, kind of in Liverpool, this kind of thing. And so I used the letter in the Mother-Daughter Wisdom. I used that letter there in Mother-Daughter Wisdom. And then I used it in my PBS show, Mother-Daughter Wisdom. Well, wouldn't you know it? The mother in Liverpool had gotten a greeting card at the store. And she just took the verbiage from inside the greeting card and put it in the letter. And I thought that the person who receives the letter owns the copyright. I had permission and all that. Well, turns out, no. Those words belong to some guy who then sued me, Hay House, PBS, and Random House. All of us. Because Hay House had helped produce the PBS special. Random House published the book. And then PBS brought it up and then I was sued. So that took about 2 years to settle. Now, Then what happens? Let's see what else. I'm first on Oprah in 1999, because by then Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom was out. And also a guy, a wonderful man named Jack Wilson out of Chicago, listened to a lecture that I gave at the Chautauqua Institute. And I didn't know it was, you know, it was all over NPR. And he listened to it and his wife said, oh, Jack, you've got to see if you can do a TV show with her. So Jack said, so I went just to see if you were visually appropriate. And then I met Jack, and Jack produced my first four public television specials. And that's how I came to the attention of Oprah. And on the first, my first appearance on Oprah in January of 1999, turned out to be the last day of my 24-year marriage, because my husband at that time didn't like being called Mrs. Northrup. And so here I was. I'm a Libra. I've got four planets in the fourth house. It's all about, I've wanted to be married with children, meals on the table. That's just in my soul. I think it's why I understand women so much and nurturing. And I never intended to transform women's health on planet Earth. I just loved my work, and I was moved to tears when I saw a baby born. Well, the marriage just couldn't continue because, and by then, by the way, I had surgery for a fibroid that was that big. And once I got on stage in New York City, fibroids, by the way, are pushing life energy, creative energy into a dead end job or relationship. Okay, so that's what a fibroid is. And mine got bigger and bigger. I got on the stage once in New York City and I said, I have a fibroid as big as my husband's head. Huh. When I had the surgery in 97, the fibroid surgery, I asked the anesthesiologist to please say the healing statements of Peggy Huddleston. Peggy Huddleston had done a lot of work on prepare for surgery, heal faster. She did a lot of her work at New England Baptist. And so I knew that when people were going under anesthesia, you were particularly suggestible. And so what I asked him to say is, and when you awaken, the pattern that created this will have left your body. And 2 years later, I was a single woman. Now, when I say this, and my first appearance on Oprah was all about that, and I wanted to be absolutely sure that they didn't include a picture of my husband or my kids or anything, I said, look, it is very important, it's crucial, actually, that you make this my story. This is my story. Menopause, by then I was in perimenopause, and here's menopause. Perimenopause is grow or die. It's grow or die. And right now, planet Earth is at perimenopause. It's grow or die. So then I had my biggest career successes ever after that. But it was devastating to me to lose my marriage. And it was devastating. But I knew that, you know, I didn't even know that a divorce was a lawsuit. I didn't even know that. And I won't go into the gnarly details, but I learned a lot very quickly. And of course, the legal system is set up to make anybody an adversary of the other person, because it puts doubt in. But we had a really good mediator who I loved, and that worked out well. We got further with 9 months of mediation, or 4 months, or whatever it was, than we did with 3 years of couples counseling. Then I was on Oprah with The Wisdom of Menopause, an enormous boost in my career. I was on Oprah about 10 times. I was on NBC Nightly News with Tom Brokaw with The Wisdom of Menopause. You know, just all kinds of great stuff happening. Then I went to a workshop, and I was given this vaginal gel made from Pararia morifica, this herb that I had never heard of, but it estrogenizes estrogen-sensitive tissue like the vaginal wall better than anything else. I set out to bring this product line to the United States, particularly this vaginal gel. But the way God had it set up is that I would, of course, be working with a psychopath who I later learned had 4 passports. I didn't know. I thought this is how you did business. I did not know. And I'll tell you, the crowning glory of everything was when I wrote Dodging Energy Vampires about personality disorder. I realized that every woman I'd ever treated who had chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, or she had Lyme disease she couldn't get over, or no matter, you do all this stuff, right? You'd eat clean, you'd drink distilled water, you'd take all these herbs, and you're still sick. Well, it's because her life energy was getting parasited by an energy vampire. And that's someone who's born with a superior ego. They think they're better than everyone else. And an empath is born with an inferior ego. So we look for things to improve about ourselves. This is a marriage made in hell that every empath has to go through. If you want to see it writ large, the pattern, so it like really gets in there, watch Dirty John on television. It's a series about a true series about a psychopath who preyed on women. They are charming. They are larger than life. They're more fun than anyone else. They're better looking. And by the way, this goes for both genders, because I've never met a really terrific doctor who wasn't at some point, didn't have a brush with some kind of a black widow kind of woman. What men do, the good men, you know, they look at the woman who looks, she doesn't have a smile on her face, and they think, oh, I can help her. I can make her happy. A good man, well, oh, I can make her happy, because that's what they're about. You can't, because all this healing is an inside job. So I didn't realize that this book, Dodging Energy Vampires, and the whole course that I did with the best people in the world, like Sandra Brown, Women Who Love Psychopaths, he wrote In Sheep's Clothing. He had worked for years with therapists. And what he said when he first started to teach about personality disorder, half the room would leave, because the people who go into therapy or they go into social work or whatever, they have a fixed belief that only people who've been hurt in childhood hurt other people. It's not true. And it's not true. And so women in 30-year marriages would then realize, oh my goodness, I've gotten farther reading his book In Sheep's Clothing than I've gotten in, you know, 4 or 5 years of couples therapy, which is just enabling people. So as you can see, everybody, my life set me up rather beautifully for when COVID happened. So in March of 2020, now in relationship with the love of my life, Ron, who had worked for the World Health Organization, was a professor of epidemiology and public health. God has a sense of humor. He says to me, you should go up to Augusta, that's our state capital, and you should testify against vaccine mandates, because they were about to remove the religious exemption, remove all exemptions, and mandate what's now 79 doses of shots by the age of 18. That's how many we're talking now, by the way. We got 200 more in the pipeline. So why don't you go and testify, says Ron. And I'm thinking, why would I ever do that? But he had done a lot of work with the legislature, and he said, those people are not that bright. So I go up there, and I also had testified against mandating the flu shot for healthcare providers. And my testimony is a matter of public record. And right after that, COVID happened. I realized that all of us, like Dr. Larry Pilevsky and a lot of us holistic docs, were testifying around the country in state houses at legislatures who wanted to mandate vaccines. For the first time, this never happened. We never had those mandates. You could always get a religious exemption, a philosophical exemption, a medical exemption. Suddenly, overnight, that all went away. We even had gathered signatures from 100,000 people in the state of Maine to reverse this mandate thing. The governor, Mills, said she would not mandate it. And the minute she got in, she mandated it, of course. So there was a huge group of us, but they put the vote in a Democratic primary election and lost. But I think that that was a stolen election anyway. So anyway, I've never been in politics. I couldn't care less. In my opinion, both parties are two rotten birds of the same two wings. They got to go. Anyhow, right after that, I was on the cover of Maine Women's Magazine. It was a fluffy interview about how I was going to get married and dancing tango and blah, 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 all of that. And suddenly on Facebook, I was public enemy number one. I have never gotten the blowback. So imagine you go from one of the 100 trusted people in America in 2013 and one of Oprah's Super Soul 100 to suddenly overnight, you're a racist, you're transphobic, you're anti-Semitic, and whatever else there is. Well, we now realize, because we're, you know, sort of past that big thing. What happened to me around then was I was compelled to get on Instagram and Facebook every night, and to just do a little ministry, as it were, to tell people this made no sense. I knew about Zev Zelenko, the Zelenko protocol. I knew that it made no sense medically to tell people to stay home until they couldn't breathe. This made all this stuff that was happening, BLM burning up cities, they're burning up the opportunity zones where all the black businesses were. What's that about? Conspiracy theorist, by the way, is a term invented by the CIA. And it started right after the Warren Report, after JFK was killed. That's when conspiracy theorists came into the lexicon. Anyhow, suddenly overnight, the world turned upside down. But you can see, can't you, that my career put me solidly in the place where I could see something is really off here. Something's really off. And because I'd had so many lawsuits, because I knew that the law was kind of a fictitious thing, and because I knew that you could keep yourself healthy with an immune system, and that also because I'm also a student of the near-death experience. So I was good friends with Dying to Be Me, the author of that, beautiful, beautiful woman who died. And she died for however many minutes. And then she was told all these egg-sized tumors that she had. She would need skin grafts. She comes back to life and her body heals just fine. Anita Morjani is her name. So that was the sea in which I was swimming. So I knew that we are made in the image of God, and that, as Jesus said, these things and more ye shall do also. And then I'm watching Christian churches, Franklin Graham, Billy's son, saying if Jesus were alive today, he would recommend the COVID shot. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, didn't he raise Lazarus from the dead? I don't think so. So there was all this stuff. And then I would say probably my greatest accomplishment, I mean, we're only going to know this like 2 years from now, but my greatest accomplishment in the fall of 2021, I was named one of the Disinformation Dozen, and that is the 12 people on planet Earth responsible for 70% of the disinformation about COVID on the internet. And I lost 3 Instagram channels. I just stopped pretty much using Facebook except for puppies and kittens. But now things have turned around. So my Twitter feed is growing and I have a Substack, and, you know, so those, but what happened that was so fascinating to me is all those women who had followed me for 30 years, many of them just said, she has lost her mind. She has lost her mind. I have one friend who was in a group of those women. She said, they're all talking about how you've lost your mind. But I always liked where your mind went. So I said, I'm going to go find what happened to her mind. So we're now, the wind's at my back at this point, because it's all coming out now. And I was sitting next to Warren Geek at the Bible College out in Tulsa, because I get a call from Clay Clark. I want you to come and talk at the first Reawaken America tour. So I'm at this Rhema Bible College in Tulsa. I'm learning about, people are coming up saying, can they pray for me? I'd never had this kind of Christianity in my life, not ever. And I was very moved because we had 5,000 people all together in April of 2021, when in the rest of the world, everyone's told, stay 6 feet apart. I knew that was bogus as well. So it was a, sort of the beginning of a whole new audience and a whole new way of thinking. You don't have to believe any of that. You just have to be a good person and keep your vibration high. But that's my story. Oh, also, and then Ron, my beloved, thought he had ALS. I didn't think that he had ALS, but he just at that age and stage, he couldn't do the inner work to turn that around. And he also was Captain America. So there was no way he was going to get crippled and have people take care of him. And he was the first person in the state of Maine to take his own life with death with dignity, with the pill. But that didn't happen here because here in my house, I was taking care of him toward the end. His adult children took him up to his place in northern Maine. That's a whole other story that I've told on other formats. But, you know, again, our beloveds like that, he's still with me. That man was the final piece that gave me the courage to go do what I have been doing since, like all this menstrual cycle research we're doing with my cycle story. Because Ron, as a professor of epidemiology who'd worked with the World Health Organization, looked at the true data on vaccines and he said, "You are right." And I thought that the relationship would founder on the rocks of vaccines, because at this point, if you're in public health, that's all you got. They're not interested in the air, in the water. And, you know, and if you look at the people who are running public health around the globe, they're some of the unhealthiest people you will ever see. It was like God said, okay, we're going to give you this experience in your physical human body of being completely loved as a woman. And it was like the final piece. Thank you, Ron. Yeah, it healed something so deeply within me. So now I just go and tell the truth as I see it anywhere.
Dr. Northrup, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you mentioned losing your professorship. And that is one of the things I really wanted you to speak to, if you have just a few more moments.
Yeah, that was in when I wrote The Wisdom of Menopause. Suddenly, I got a letter from the University of Vermont. So I was a professor at the University of Vermont College of Medicine, but at Maine Medical Center in Portland, Maine. And I taught medical students and all the rest of it. And then one day I got a letter and, you know, we've decided to evict you. And that was in, don't remember, I think maybe 19 something. I don't know. It's funny. That was like a shot over the bow, you know. Yeah, that was predictive programming of what's going to happen. But remember, every time I walked into the doctor's lounge, all those years that I was a professor, I was waiting for my pink slip to be in my mailbox. This was before the internet. I'll tell you why. A person put, I'll never forget this, they tacked a medical paper on the bulletin board, and it was a controlled clinical trial of people who had been prayed for or the control group in the intensive care unit. There are, I think, at least 300 incredible studies on the power of prayer put together by my colleague, Dr. Larry Dossey. And so this was this peer-reviewed study in a good medical journal. And one of the doctors had written in magic marker, bullshit. Okay. That's where we are, people. And that divide has gotten more and more and more and more. Yeah, I had even forgotten about losing the professorship. I was one of the early adapters. Now we've got really big guys. We've got Pierre Corey. We've got, you know, all kinds of Ryan Cole, all these wonderful people. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your sharing that. And I know you have a schedule to keep. So I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. I feel your brilliant light and your beautiful heart and your dedication has obviously helped so many people and will continue through your books, through your products, through your messages. And I only hope that this message is available to those who need to hear it.
Yes. Beautiful. Thank you.
I invite my listeners to return again next week and have another conversation with me, because now is the time for interspecies evolution. The information provided in this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional, medical, psychiatric, or veterinary advice. Our conversations are based on our life's experiences. We intend this podcast to be complementary and supportive. It is not intended to be a substitute for traditional medical, psychiatric, or veterinary care. If you need a doctor, a psychiatrist, or a veterinarian, please contact one immediately.